Hi, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Wednesday on KYUK Radio. This is Public Health's Wednesday of the month. I'm Donna Bean, a public health nurse here. And today I have guests with me. We're going to be discussing the impact on a person whose mother drank alcohol during pregnancy. This month of September is Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders, or FASD, Awareness Month. And the theme of the month this year is alcohol and pregnancy. No safe amount, no safe time, no safe alcohol, period. Annually, September 9th is International FASD Awareness Day, with the goal of promoting education and awareness on FASD. And the entire month of September has been designated as FASD Awareness Month. So our main message for listeners today is that FASD is completely preventable if alcohol is completely avoided during pregnancy. We've got two guests here today, Marilyn Pierce-Bolger, who is a nurse practitioner and also the owner manager of FASD or FASD Diagnosis Services LLC. And I've also got Elizabeth Joseph, who is in Conganac, and she is a parent to FASD children. So if there are any listeners out there today who'd like to ask questions at any point, you can call in to 1-800-995-8954, or you can even email radio@kyuk.org. So I'd like to thank our guests today, Marilyn and Elizabeth, for taking time out of their busy schedules to be here today. I know that our listeners are going to learn a lot of important and relevant information on FASD. So first off, it'd be great if each of you could introduce yourself and just tell us and listeners a little bit about what it is you do. Okay, I think Marilyn was disconnected. Is Elizabeth there?
Yes, I'm here. My name is Elizabeth Joseph. I'm from Conganac. I'm a parent of 5 adopted children, 2 of whom are diagnosed with FASD and FASD. I serve on 2 boards in the state as a parent. I serve on the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, and also on the Alaska Center for FASD Board of Directors. I'm also a FASD 101 trainer for 6 years now, and I work here in our village clinic as an office assistant. And I was also a parent, a foster parent from 2005 to about 2013.
Okay. And what is FASD 101?
FASD 101 is like learning, the beginning stages of learning about FASD, like the tragedies of, and the signs of facial features and signs you may see in children that are not diagnosed yet.
And is Marilyn on the line?
I think I am.
Awesome. Yes, we can hear you, Marilyn, if you could introduce yourself.
So I'm Marilyn Pierce-Bolger. I'm a nurse midwife and a nurse practitioner. I lived in Bethel in the 70s and was actually inspired by the local Yupik and Athabascan women to become a midwife. So when I left Bethel, I went and did that. And then I worked at ANMC for about 25 years, so some of your listeners may remember my name. In the mid-90s, I was asked by ANMC to see if we could explore why Native babies in Anchorage were dying at higher rates over the non-Native children. And when the public health nurse that worked at the hospital and I began to look at that and really began to work with those families, we discovered there was a pretty high percentage of the moms themselves who had a disability that had never been identified for them. So what was happening is these were young women who were trying to parent and were having difficulty doing that, and they might be connecting with a partner who didn't have their best interest in mind. So over the course of 5 years, we worked with these families. I did. That program still exists at South Central Foundation. It's called Mutoxovic, and it's a family home visitation model to support families with very young children. Anyhow, fast forward, I really felt like identifying a child who has brain-based differences at a younger age is incredibly important. So that's how I ended up getting into the work of doing FASD diagnosis now with primarily children under the age of 18.
Okay, great. Thank you, both of you. We'll go ahead and get started. So FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, is something that some of us have heard of. It's an acronym that we often hear out here, but so we're going to delve into that a little bit, starting with the U.S. Surgeon General advises all pregnant women and women who are considering becoming pregnant to abstain from alcohol consumption or just zero drinks to eliminate any alcohol-exposed pregnancies. But it's currently estimated that about 40,000 babies are born each year with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And this term is an umbrella term describing a range of effects that can occur in an individual who was exposed to alcohol before being born. So, Marilyn, if you could start us off and let us know, is there any safe amount of exposure to alcohol for a developing baby? And does it matter what kind of alcoholic beverage the developing baby is exposed to?
So because the mother-baby pair are each unique, meaning that they have their own genetics, their own history in terms of development. Mom's history, of course, goes back generations, as does her partner's dad's. That then is what's contributing to baby's genetics. The timing of the use, the fact that no alcohol in pregnancy is considered safe because we can't predict what any single mother-baby pair would, how they would react to it. And one of the things I'd make a comment about is that it's not just alcoholic beverages that present a risk for a developing baby. We've had some children who've come through the diagnostic team here in Anchorage whose moms were sick and drinking bottles of NyQuil, for example, and NyQuil is 10% alcohol.
Oh.
And that happened to be the source of their alcohol exposure. So you really, if you're a reproductive age woman, and we define that as being, you know, women basically between teenage years and 45, you really need to be mindful of your own body and your cycle and where you are in your cycle and what you're doing in terms of how you're using alcohol and whether or not there's a possibility you're pregnant.
Okay, so no safe amount of exposure because we don't know what's going to happen, and it doesn't matter what kind of alcohol, any alcohol beverage and anything that contains any percentage of alcohol, including things
exactly.
Like NyQuil,
yeah.
Other cough medicines. What about something like kombucha that's fermented?
I've had that question before, and the alcohol content in kombucha really varies.
Okay.
It's definitely a fermented product, and so I don't know that we know. Nobody's really looked at that, but I think that anything that you're drinking that's a fermented product that may contain an alcohol is something you've got to be mindful of when you're pregnant.
Okay. So drinking any kind of alcohol during pregnancy can impact a child's physical, mental, behavioral, and even cognitive development. What's the difference then between fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, and fetal alcohol syndrome, FAS? And is it important to make a distinction between these two terms?
Do you want me to answer that again?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. So fetal alcohol syndrome was the first thing we identified back when we figured out that drinking alcohol during pregnancy might be harmful. And that was identified at the University of Washington back in 1973, so really relatively recently in history. So the kids who have full FAS have to meet criteria for that diagnosis, which means they have a very specific pattern of facial features, and that includes a small eye opening, a very thin upper lip relative to the fullness of that lower lip, and then there's a little vertical up and down groove between the nose and the upper lip, and that's pretty flat or not very distinct in kids who have FAS. They also have to have meet criteria for what we call growth deficiency, where their heights or weights are below the 10th percentile, and they have evidence of brain-based differences or damage. Now, because the facial features are only impacted by the alcohol in the third week of pregnancy, That's essentially the week after mom's missed her period. If she didn't have the alcohol hit during that week, if she wasn't drinking during those days, or she wasn't drinking in a significant amount that might have actually altered that baby's facial structure, then this child may not have the facial features. And I'll say most of the kids we see through the diagnostic teams do not meet criteria for full FAS. However, they all have evidence of brain-based differences, and the reason for that is that the brain is developing the entire 9 months from conception to the time when the baby comes out at birth. Different parts of the brain are being impacted at different stages of development, and so the kids who are on the spectrum, on the fetal alcohol spectrum, those kids have evidence of brain-based disorders. But they don't have these physical findings like the kids with FAS have.
Okay. So FAS refers specifically to something that we can see physically, the facial features of alcohol consumption by mom during her third week of pregnancy.
Yes.
And then now every...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, the other thing I'm going to say about alcohol is what we call a teratogen. It's a big word, but what it means is it has the power to kill and alter cells in the developing baby. So alcohol can actually cause other structural malformations in a baby. And sometimes we've seen kids who have, say, very small lower jaws or very crowded teeth, or they have super loose, lax joints, or they might have flat feet, or they might have a hole in their heart, or some orthopedic abnormalities. Alcohol, depending on the timing when the alcohol is impacting that baby, it can cause other structural damage besides the facial features, and that's not commonly known.
Yeah, I did not know that. Okay. So the number of children born with FAS alone is 1 in 1,000. And you can compare that to something like Down syndrome, which is 6 to 9 children born with that out of every 1,000. So studies show that up to 1 in 20 U.S. school children may be on the spectrum of FASD. Mm-hmm. But that's different from autism. You gave me these numbers. So 1 in 20 with FASD on the FASD spectrum, 1 in 59 compared to 1 in 59 with autism.
Those are brand new numbers. Both are 2018 numbers. For national data, those are not Alaska data.
Is it different in Alaska?
We don't have the answer for prevalence data of FASDs in Alaska. We know that our FAS rate is 1.7, I think, per thousand when they looked at it last, when the state looked at that last. And again, you have to remember that the kids who have full FAS, we refer to it as sort of the tip of the iceberg. It's a very small percentage of the kids who have the, you know, the structural facial features and the height issue, but all the kids on the spectrum have brain-based differences. And so you would multiply that 1.7 times 10. Mm-hmm. So there might be 170 kids a year born in Alaska who have FASDs.
Okay, and they're going to need, they might have special needs depending on what, where they are on that spectrum.
Yes, and, yeah. And the other thing that's interesting about FASDs, and again, it goes back to that, we can't predict for any mother-baby pair what might, you know, unfold for that particular baby. The other things that go into what might influence why, you know, how that kiddo looks in terms of their development or their behavior over time is mom's own stress level plays a role, her hormone, cortisol and other levels, her micronutrient levels, which we can't measure. If she's using something else like ICMIC or other kinds of tobacco or marijuana, we actually had recent, there was an interesting researcher that I was listening to recently who had looked in animals. He'd looked at the combination of alcohol and marijuana together and what was happening to the babies of children, you know, who had had both of those exposures, and they are actually combining to make the impact worse. So we know that the combination of things together can, like, make that, you know, manifestation of how that child might look might really be different over time. And Elizabeth, I'm sure, can talk to you in a few minutes here about sort of what that looks like with her kids. Many of the kids may look fine for quite a while. Commonly, we'll see kids that may start having attention or hyperactivity problems during the preschool years. Mm-hmm. And then that may unfold over time as having trouble with learning. Maybe math and reading really get hard for them, and that often might happen around third, fourth grade when things start getting harder. Or they may really have a hard time connecting and making a friend and keeping a friend. You know, those are, interestingly, those social skills is a brain-based problem.
So it would be really great if people could get diagnosed early so that parents could know what sort of needs their children might have or difficulties they might encounter.
Absolutely. And really one of the things we want to try to look at is let's just, because alcohol is used so commonly in our larger culture. I mean, we use it to celebrate, we use it at funerals, we use it, you know, for all kinds of things. And because half of women still get pregnant when they don't plan on it, mm-hmm. that number is an Alaska number, and it's actually true over most of the country, too. We may have an exposure early in pregnancy in terms of alcohol exposure that we didn't intend and that, you know, is just complete, you know, oh, my gosh, it happened. Those kids also should be, you know, monitored for their development, because it may be that even though there was that early exposure that didn't go through the whole pregnancy, they may still have some impact from that.
So even a one-time celebratory weekend or something early in pregnancy could have long-term effects.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true.
Okay. Elizabeth, would you be able to speak about maybe when you found out your children were diagnosed, and what specific, you know, physical characteristics or special needs that they might have and that are common in children with FASD?
With my children, I knew from the beginning with my oldest child, and then I knew fairly a little with the second child, but the first child that I adopted was, he didn't really speak, and he wasn't really his motor skills were really developed slow. He was 11 months when I first took him, and he was just army crawling. And then when he was about, I think, 17 months, he finally started walking.
Okay.
Or 18 months. And then he didn't really speak words until he was about 3 or 4. And then with the second one, he doesn't have the facial features, but he has the hidden features of kind of slow, so not really social, and he's like strange. I call him my stranger danger, because strangers aren't really, stranger is not really a word to him. So I try to keep him like
vulnerable, Elizabeth, and right?
He has trouble a lot in school, but getting him services is really hard because his features are hidden. And, you know, I think it would help if teachers or providers would listen to the parents, because parents do know their children.
When did your children get diagnosed?
Both of my children weren't able to get diagnosed till they were 5 years old, over 5 years old, because with YKC, they can't diagnose until they're 5.
Oh, why is that?
I guess I don't really have the answer to that, but I think it's more like they don't have in the training or the ability to diagnose at an early age compared to like Anchorage area.
I can answer that question. One of the things that's tricky about doing the diagnosis when the kids are are younger is, first of all, there may not be as much evidence of impact at that age. However, from what Elizabeth was just describing with one of her children, that child who, you know, wasn't walking till quite a bit later than typical and who wasn't saying words, those are really big red flags. You know, you really, that's why we do developmental screening with kids that's standardized. And the ages and stages kind of screening is a really, it's one tool that can help us know, is my child developing like other kids the same age? And the testing tools they use with little kids, like she said, there are some professionals who are not as comfortable using them. And there are professionals who don't understand the value of diagnosis at a younger age. So some of the diagnostic teams in Alaska really had their cutoff age at around, you know, 5. And the bottom line about that is that it's probably doing a disservice to some of these kids, because we know from the research at the University of Washington that the kids who get a diagnosis before age 6 and who are living in a stable environment most of their life, who are not having trauma, that trauma piece is a whole other radio show, because that impacts the child's brain as well, particularly if it's happening in the first 1 to, you know, from birth to age 3. If those kids are not getting that stimulation that they should be getting and the nurturing, their brain starts changing, and it rewires itself in terms of its language centers and other parts. Anyhow, I've become a big proponent over my years of doing this work now. We founded the team in Anchorage in 2009, and I am very firmly feeling like we should be seeing kids prior to age 6 for an initial evaluation, and then looking at them again at another age when they get a little closer to 8 or 9, because you have windows of when you can get them some services to really support their development. And the cool thing about brains is we know brains have some plastic. It's called plasticity. Brains can make new connections. And that's what the therapies do. That's what speech-language therapy does or occupational therapy. And if you want a child whose brain is a young brain in order to start getting those new wiring, we cannot create what didn't get put there to begin with because of the alcohol damage, but we can make workarounds that are helpful for the child.
Okay. So for anyone who's just tuning in, I've got Marilyn Pierce-Bolger and Elizabeth Joseph, and we're talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. We've just talked about in the last 20 minutes or so about how no level of alcohol, including not just alcoholic drinks, but things like NyQuil, things that contain alcohol, none of these are safe, and a baby's brain is developing for the entire 9 months. So alcohol at any point could pose health, physical, and mental cognitive risks to the baby. If anyone has any questions, the number to call is 1-800-995-8954, or you can email radio@kyuk.org. So before that, Marilyn, I had a question because you mentioned, you know, we should be trying to diagnose before 6 years old. And Elizabeth, uh-huh. You mentioned that your children were not diagnosed until five. Given the high rate of use of alcohol, especially in Alaska, would you recommend that all babies be screened? Regardless of maybe any facial or physical or other symptoms or signs, should that become a standard screening that we do here?
That's actually a very good question, and it's one that the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education is looking at right now. I'm part of that group that's created a five-year strategic plan related to FASD in Alaska. And what we are recommending, a couple of different things. I see many health professionals who are very misinformed or uninformed about FASDs. Their training programs teaches them something about full FAS, but as I said, that's not the most common condition that you may have if you've had prenatal exposure to alcohol. Many health providers in Alaska are giving women misinformation and telling them it's okay to have a little alcohol in pregnancy, which is absolutely not true. So there's some work being done right now with the Alaska Mental Health Trust and a marketing firm, Northwest Strategies, to help get the word out to medical professionals about what FASDs are and how they can have conversations with women about alcohol use. Just how they use alcohol generally, not even just specific to pregnancy. The other thing that I'm recommending as a with my midwife hat on is that if we have conversations with women at their new prenatal appointments and we learn a little bit about their health history and you know whether they might use tobacco or alcohol or other things, We need to make recommendations right then about what would be safe for that pregnancy. And I think we need to be clearly identifying that the child's story, you know, through our prenatal problem list process, includes the fact that alcohol is part of their story. And it's not to blame or shame. I will tell you, the birth moms I have worked with over my thousands and thousands of women I've worked with over the years, birth moms have a story. If they have a drinking problem they cannot stop, they truly have a story. And then there's other birth moms who are the, oh, my gosh, I'm pregnant, I'm going to not, you know, drink anymore, but they may still have a child that has a problem. So So identifying the alcohol exposure and the prenatal problem list so that it's then available for the pediatric folks to just be watching that child with a little closer eye, and then doing standardized developmental screening for every kid in Alaska, not just to focus on the alcohol issue, but just to focus across the board on, we want all our kids in Alaska to develop appropriately. So there's efforts being made right now by Help Me Grow, which is a program that's being spread around the state, and it's using ages and stages questionnaires to, and they're getting those questionnaires into the hands of families through paper and through a website link so that families can do it either online or on paper. And so that's being spread around. And then if you have a child who doesn't quite hit the mark with regard to where their development is, like Elizabeth's kiddos, then you can do further investigation to see what they might need for support and services.
So you guys are recommending then, you're developing recommendations at the statewide level for sort of how to screen for FASD and get information to parents, but also how to equip healthcare professionals with more information so that they can better diagnose and better educate patients when they come in?
Yes.
Okay.
And then do universal developmental screening on all the kids.
Yeah, so that's something public health nursing does. I know that when we perform physical or well child exams, and developmental screening is a component. I believe YKHC, I'm not sure if they also provide a developmental screening during their well childs. I'm assuming so. But that's why I also think well childs are really important. This is a personal plug. Do you think that some of these things could have been caught during a developmental screening or a well child exam? I know it's hard for some communities. Maybe the clinic doesn't have a health aide who's trained at the level to provide a well child, or uh-huh. maybe scheduling is difficult. But especially during the first year, do you believe that well childs are important during the first year or the first 5 years to be done on a timely manner?
Oh, absolutely. I am a huge proponent of that. And I think it's for all kids' development. The other thing I've seen when I look at medical records, because I do look at pediatric records when I'm working with kids that we're doing diagnoses for, I see medical providers sometimes sort of hesitating to act occasionally on a maybe a soft sign of something that's a delay. They may wait another few months until it's, you know, maybe more clear. The problem with that approach for kids who we know have prenatal alcohol exposure is that you're then delaying some interventions. And so that goes back to my point I made earlier about it's really important that healthcare providers are capturing the information and that women be upfront about, hey, you know, these are the things that I was doing before I realized I was pregnant, so that information is then in the medical record for the medical providers who need to know it as they're looking at this kiddo. So if the pediatric provider or the public health nurse knows, gee, alcohol is part of this kid's story, then you might be a little more likely to refer that kid for more workup, you know, evaluation, if they have sort of a little bit of a delay rather than waiting for a bigger delay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's better to err on the side of caution.
Right.
Elizabeth, you're a trainer. What kinds of information are you able to provide trainings fairly often in the community, or do you think, or do you wish you could get more trainings for people just to raise awareness? What are some of the things you think would help around education with the communities?
Zoe, I like training is through personal experiences. A lot of the stuff that I learned before I had my child was, I was a preschool teacher before, and then I thought I knew FASD. or FASD. I thought I knew it all until I had my own child. And it brought me to the point where I said, you know, what I learned wasn't even right. But from my personal experiences, you know, I like using that and helping others to understand my children, because children with FAS and FASD are not, no two children are the same.
Mm-hmm.
It all comes from what part of the pregnancy the mother or the birth mother did drink, and it takes an impact on different parts of the brain. In some kids, you know, you don't even know that they were exposed because they're really smart. They can do this, they can do that. But in other little things, they lack. So, I wish that, you know, teachers or caregivers or others could, I wish there was a different way they could learn about FAS and FASD.
Well, do you work with moms when you train?
Mostly, yes. But I haven't really trained since I got my FASD 101 certificate. I do just little here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly when it comes to, you know, my kids' teachers, I always have my parental instinct to jump in and say, you know, this is what happens. He's diagnosed with FAS and he needs this. And a lot of stimulation to help him grow. And they come to me, you know, the teachers come to me and say, this is happening, what should I do? So kind of like that's how I do my training, is through teachers.
Elizabeth, I think she brings up a really good point, Donna. One of the things that happens for the kids who have FASDs, again, it's mostly what we call a hidden disability, and it shows up as learning or attention or behavior or social problems. And her example, I think, of teachers saying, you know, what do? My guess is that we have at least one child with FASD in every classroom in Alaska, and mm-hmm. probably more in some classrooms. And teachers aren't necessarily skilled or have been trained in terms of how to help those kids. And one of the things that I see a lot of the kids experience, and Elizabeth, you can tell me if your kids have this issue, the sensory system is put together very differently often. And our senses are our taste and our touch and our vision and our hearing and our ability of knowing where we are in space, you know, sort of, do we run into things because we don't, you know, see it there or realize it's there? So our sensory system can be very impacted, and what happens for some of the kids is they're being very distracted in a classroom, or they have to move in order to learn, or they have other behaviors that may annoy the other kids in the class, but they're doing it because they need that input. One of the things we want to do, you know, with the five-year plan, with the Governor's Council work, and with the nonprofit, the Alaska Center for FASD, that Elizabeth and I are both involved with, is let's figure out how to get real-world solutions at the level, you know, where they're needed, which is where where the parents are, you know, in their living rooms, you know, working with their kids and raising their kids, and in the classrooms with teachers where the teachers are needing help to know how to help these kids. And I'm really of the opinion that if we were to look at our classrooms and make some modifications in them to help kids who have FASDs, it wouldn't be bad for the kids who don't have FASDs, and it certainly would help those who need the, you know, the different sensory or other environment.
Well, what are some of these interventions or treatments that a person with FASD needs? There's basic, you know, medical care that everyone needs, like well childs or vaccines and exercise, good diet. But what are the things that FASD children need specifically?
Elizabeth, do you want to answer that?
What was that question?
What types of treatments or interventions specific to FASD are needed to help improve a child's development?
I think each child is unique. Each child has a different need. And my children, for example, the oldest one, his first thing was he needed to spin, fast spin. You know, the spin where it lets you see when, for a person like me, I get dizzy afterwards, but it centered him. And then it moved into mouth stimulation to where he had to chew on something, and then it gradually moved on to having something like fizzy in the mouth, like a can of pop. I noticed he'd have a can of pop, and then he'd swish it around his mouth until there was no more fizz, and then he swallowed it. And that's been his centering and his centering piece. And then the second boy, his centering is getting a blanket and putting it up to his face, and sometimes he'll thumb suck. He hasn't really moved away from that, but it really helps him. I think with the first one, when he was given to me by OCS, they told me he might have delays and his failure to thrive and all that. And they didn't really tell me that he might have been exposed until maybe a month or 2 months after I had him in my care, when I was wondering why is he so delayed. And I was lucky enough to have Fit was coming out and helping me with how to deal with him. And then from Fit, he moved on to... He transitioned into the school where he got services. So he's had services since he's been about a little before he was a year old. But with the second boy, because he has his hidden features, is he was in Fit for a while, and then he graduated because he was borderline, but he's having a really hard time learning in school, and they keep coming to me, you know, this is happening, that's happening. It's like, I've been trying to get him to get some help in the school, get some services going for him, but he's having a lot of problems here and there.
Mm-hmm. So for you, you said that for helping improve outcomes for both of your children, first you had to know them and be present with them and observe what helped them and what didn't. And it sort of took a while, but you figured out the different, activities or different strategies that helped, you know, one with the blanket and thumb sucking and your other child with drinking soda just to calm them. So you as a parent were there and able to be with them and observe, but you also had access to resources like the Family Infant Toddler Program through YK and Head Start, and then also through the clinic. So do you think I know that Head Start is in a lot of communities out in the YK Delta, and we've also got the clinics, but do you think parenting classes would also help for someone who's parent to child with FASD?
Yes.
Okay. I know we have some parenting classes here in Bethel through ABCP, OTNC, Healthy Families programs, and those are some of the resources we have here. I don't know, Marilyn.
The other thing I would say is when we're talking about parenting strategies, and for that matter, education strategies, we have to think about, we sort of have to step back and look at what the evidence is with each child. What are the behaviors or what are the signs that they're giving you that maybe they need to have something done a little differently? I had a 15-year-old that we did diagnosis for a number of years ago, and he was at West High School here in Anchorage, flunking algebra when he was in a regular classroom. But when he did that same lesson, that same class on the computer at home in a quiet environment, he had an A. And then in the fall, when he went back, his mom couldn't get him into Algebra 2, so she put him back in 1 because she was afraid he would, you know, not remember it. And he was flunking again, and it was completely related to the environment. So what Elizabeth's saying about each of these kids is different is absolutely right. And then we also have to sort out how can we help the kiddo with their given, you know, their specific differences, brain-based differences, do things better. One of the other sort of treatment things we see that many of the kids benefit from, the language part of our brain is one of the biggest parts of our brain, and so it's often something that's had some damage as a result of the alcohol exposure. And the child may be talking and sounding like they know what they're talking about, but they may not be getting that information inside. They may not be processing the information the teacher is giving them or the directions or, you know, something that the parent is asking them to do correctly. So the incoming message is not getting through correctly. So that's where a speech language person can help with helping them with some therapy to help strategies around how to improve that incoming messages. The other big area is the whole social language stuff, which we all take it for granted. You know, we humans probably use more body language and facial expression and other things other than words to communicate with each other. But if that part of the brain has been damaged because of the alcohol, then the child is at a huge disadvantage and they're not reading those kinds of cues well, and that makes them vulnerable. There are more speech language folks that are starting to do stuff online, telespeech, it's mm-hmm. called. There's also teleoccupational therapy, and I know that the new neurodevelopmental clinic over at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, ANMC, is going to be offering some telehealth services. Mm-hmm. So there may be more opportunities in the future to to get services to small communities like Elizabeth and Kungiganak, so that the kids are getting more frequent services than maybe the school district can provide for them, or Head Start for that matter. Yeah, and Head Start's a great program because they, you know, they're looking at child enrichment and they're also doing screening for health conditions at the same time.
Yeah, that's really great to have. I know we don't have access to all these resources, but when we do, we have better outcomes than if we didn't. But in public health, we focus a lot on the prevention side of things. And so before the end of the conversation, I just wanted to touch base on, unfortunately, and not to stigmatize women, but women do carry the baby. And so anything that goes into the woman's body, in this case, alcohol, and sometimes other substances, can severely impact the health of the baby. So what are some of the strategies both of you have seen to help stop or reduce maternal alcohol use? I just wanted to touch on that because that is a big issue in our community here in Bethel and the villages, especially with our local option status. So I don't know what sort of messaging is different or what things you have seen work in helping reduce alcohol consumption so that we can prevent this from happening altogether.
I can tell you what's being done nationally and what we're going to be doing more of in Alaska, and that is doing universal screening with adults and adolescents in terms of alcohol and substance use.
Okay.
Not specific to FASD, just more to say, how do you use alcohol, right?
So every time you go to a doctor or a medical provider, they would ask questions. Okay.
And here's one point that I want to make. There's a term called binge drinking, mm-hmm. and there's a misconception that a binge drinking person has to be like drop down drunk, right?
Mm-hmm.
For women, the definition of too much alcohol or a binge is more than three standard drinks. Okay, so a standard drink, if you think about it, is one shot or one beer or 1 ounce or 5 ounces of wine if somebody's a wine drinker.
Mm-hmm.
So that means if you have three shots or more, for a woman, that's a binge. And you may be able to hold that liquor, but that amount of that volume of alcohol is the level that we worry about for sure in terms of the higher impact on a developing baby. The other thing that routinely talking about alcohol and helping people understand how they use alcohol relative to what might be lower risk use patterns, that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that's being really promoted is helping women understand the connection between alcohol and their behaviors around their sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may use alcohol to be less inhibited because we want to have sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we're going to do that, then let's make sure we've got a really effective birth control method on board.
Yeah.
And the birth control products really vary in terms of what's effective. And we know that the things that we call LARCs or long-acting reversible methods are the ones that are going to be more highly effective. So that's the Nexplanon and the IUDs and Depo. But even Depo, you have to get a shot every 3 months. So it means you got to remember to do something. So combining the long-acting methods of birth control with paying attention and learning about how your alcohol use compares with, you know, low-risk use has been shown to actually make a difference in terms of women having less risk for having an alcohol-exposed pregnancy.
Yeah. So, Elizabeth, did you have anything?
From personal experiences, I think finding a support system both before and after works very well. I have a friend from Guyana that I have a shoulder to lean on when I run into a brick wall and I don't know what to do. She is my support system. She's all the way up in Guyana, but she helps me a lot. And I think even, you know, for a person that drinks alcohol and they find out that they're pregnant, they should find a support system, somebody to call when you feel like you need to, if you want to drink or, you know.
Very good point, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
It's good to find someone that will help you along. You know, 9 months isn't very long.
Yeah.
No, it's not. And here's the other thing that we know is that women tend to drink with their men. And so we can ask men to help by not drinking for those 9 months as well.
Is there messaging around that? Just letting them know that the baby's health is everyone's.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And there's actually some new information about a field called epigenetics, where even if dad using alcohol heavily can be affecting the quality of his sperm to the extent that that may have a multi-generational impact. And we know the same is true for moms. So if mom, there's an interesting study done with mice a year ago, but there's been lots more done than just that study. They gave the mom mouse, the pregnant mouse, alcohol, and then they looked at what happened for those mouse pups, and they had learning problems and, interestingly, anxiety and a smaller body size and a smaller brain and some differences in the brain in terms of how it was wired. But then they looked at the next two generations, the second and the third generation, and those two generations did not get alcohol. They were just, you know, mouse pups that were raised, and they had the identical impact. So what we're learning about alcohol is that because it's a teratogen, it has the power to actually alter things through multi-generations, whether all those generations are drinking or not. And that's really worrisome.
So if my great grandmother was an alcoholic drank every day, it could have affected me in my development.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's actually, I want to make a point about why we insist on having a clear alcohol history when we're being asked to do this diagnosis. It's for that exact reason. Because there are women who swear, I did not drink during this pregnancy, and yet their child has, you know, developmental problems. And there can be other reasons for that, but we're also now learning there may be this sort of what we call epigenetic multi-generational impact that's showing up over time.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time. I just wanted to leave callers with your information, or at least a website and a phone number to call. Marilyn, if you could give us information on your office, just a phone number.
Yep. So my office number is 907-865-3279. And I also want to point people to our website, which is F, like Frank, FASDXServices.com. If somebody Googles that website, there's a brochure on there, a couple brochures that you can print off. One of them is Recognizing Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder, and it's set up by ages. So it shows you what you might see in a preschool child or a baby, or what you might see in a school-aged child or a teenager or an adult. So there's a list of signs or symptoms. You know, it's not all the signs or symptoms, and alcohol may not be the only reason why somebody has those symptoms, but at least it gives people an idea about what that might look like over time. And then the Alaska Center for FASD is a new nonprofit, and as we mentioned, Elizabeth and I are involved with that, and we really want to do some work around the state looking at advocacy for birth moms, for, you know, let's get treatment programs that work for women. We know that that's a whole other radio show. And let's get women like Elizabeth and Kai Giganek, who are raising kids with FASDs, a support system so they have somebody to call and talk to just when they need somebody to strategize with. Let's set up a system that's a phone or whatever, you know, we need it to be based system. And so that's the Alaska Center for FASD.org.
Great. And Lastly, for listeners, to make sure and get well child exams for children on a regular basis and during the first year and the first few years of life. And if we can get somebody to Anchorage just for an FASD diagnosis, if it's prior to 5 or at YKHC, they can do that around 5 years old. So just making sure that we're watching the development of our children and that they get developmental screenings and just observing and being there to understand what might be going on. And any screening, any preventive thing, measures we can take, getting them to see a pediatrician on time can help improve outcomes for the rest of their life.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, thank you both, Marilyn and Elizabeth. I really appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
Okay. Have a great Wednesday.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.